Looks like they're all coming in.
Yep. I'm going to give them a minute to all hop on, and then I'll kick us off.
Okay.
I'm going to mute you guys. You'll need to unmute yourselves. Patrick and Margaret and Steve, please unmute yourselves.
All right, I'm unmuted.
I'm ready to go.
All right. Steve, are you ready?
Let's roll.
All right. Welcome to Fun with the Far. Before we get started, I have a couple of housekeeping announcements because I want to go over a few things that are different from this session on. So, as we get started here, I want to let everyone know that at the beginning of this year, we were going to go over to text-only passwords in the chat. We did this because we wanted to not interrupt the flow of the session with the passwords, but everyone has given us a lot of feedback on that, and it's become overwhelmingly apparent that you guys strongly prefer the verbal passwords. So we're going to go back to that. During the program, we're going to give out three, count them, three passwords. Write those down. At the end of the program, put those three passwords together, and you'll find yourself looking at a trivia question. Be the first person to toss that in the chat, and you'll win a fabulous PCI prize. PCI prizes range from PCI 10-year anniversary t-shirts, a beautiful t-shirt that Steve has right in front of us. We have black Fun with the Far t-shirts, as we've always had. We have Fun with the Far sports bottles. I've got one right here. We've got Fun with the Far beanies, like Steve is holding right in front of you right now. And we have other Fun with the Far prizes. If you've already collected the whole set of Fun with the Far prizes, including that gorgeous squeezy toy, you can also get a $5 Starbucks gift card, which is totally Fun with the Far themed. If you can please, Mike, mute yourself.
I'm just having too much fun, John.
All right. In addition to that, we invite your questions. At any point during the program, you can ask a question. If you have a question you want to ask, you can click the raise hand button. And at the next good inhale, Steve will ask you to unmute yourself and answer your question. If you don't like raising your hand, you don't have a mic, or you just don't like speaking into the microphone, you can always toss your question in chat, and I'll interrupt Steve at the appropriate moments. With that, I think we want to go to the polling questions. Patrick, can we post the... Oh, Steve.
One more thing. Since we've got this new portal, John, I love the fact that folks can also provide us reactions during the presentation. One of the things that I really want to do is we want interaction. So to the extent that you want to give us a thumbs up, you want to give us a heart, you want us to give us a wow, please do that. You know, again, I think it's going to add to the interaction and hopefully to the fun as well for Margaret and myself. So provide us that instant feedback. All right,
Patrick, please post poll number one.
Yep, here we go. Poll number one. First one of the day. Everyone should see a poll on their screen.
All right. Which of the following are regulated by the FAR? Contracts. Contracts entered into by an agency, federal grants, other transaction, and what's that last one, Patrick?
Contracts entered into by the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA. Which of the following are regulated by the Federal Acquisition Regulations?
I would like to ask everyone to mute their microphone if they don't.
All right, John.
All right, Patrick, can you close that poll? And then, Margaret, which of these is correct?
Number one, contracts entered into by the Department of Commerce.
That's correct. Number
looking
one.
Like 65% got there.
65%.
Thank goodness I got it right as an instructor here.
Well done, Margaret. You weren't even with us 2 weeks ago. The correct answer here is contracts entered into by, among other federal agencies, the Department of Commerce.
The feed is off of the TV, so I'm trying to figure out why.
Okay.
Other transaction agreements are not covered by or regulated by the FAR, although a lot of OTA agreements make reference to certain provisions in the FAR. Federal grants are not regulated by the FAR. Instead, they're regulated by an OMB circular. And contracts entered into by the FAA are not regulated by the FAR because the Department of Transportation promulgated regs specifically for the FAA that are different, but again, at times very similar to the federal acquisition regulations, and they're referred to as the AMS system. All right.
All right.
Let's move on to question two.
All right, question two is live now.
Which of these
problems with sound, John?
Which of these? I'm having problems with sound?
No, so we're getting some responses. People are having problems hearing.
Okay, so while we do this one, Patrick, can you post the dial-in number in the chat for people?
Yes, I can. All right, everyone who's having problems with sound, be sure to check for the dial-in number that I'm going to be putting in the chat.
So which of these people is not on the federal acquisition team? The program manager, the taxpayer, the end user, or the contracting officer? Please put your answer in that poll.
All right, John, are we ready?
All right. Yes, please close the poll. Margaret, what is the correct answer? Margaret, can you unmute yourself?
I muted. Oh, boy, this is tough. I'm going to say taxpayer.
Yes, that is correct.
Taxpayer is the correct answer. Now, Margaret, one of the things that the FAR Council makes clear is although the taxpayer is not on the acquisition team, as defined in FAR Part 1, they are considered the ultimate customer for any federal acquisition and or procurement. And the reason for that, of course, is the government is using our money to pay for services and products that the government needs. So one of the things that a contracting officer and other members of the acquisition team need to take into consideration is protecting the public fisc. So the correct answer here, in fact, is taxpayer, and 97% of you got that answer correct. Well done.
All right. Patrick, let's post the next poll.
All right. The third poll should be live now.
Ooh, this one's challenging. A determination and finding must have which of the following? A written legal opinion from agency counsel, a citation of the appropriate statute or regulation upon which the determination and finding is based, a signature from the contract awardee, or a photo of the contracting officer.
Maybe not so hard.
It's the options that help. Yes. All right. I think we can close this in just another moment.
All right. We got overwhelmingly a citation of the appropriate statute and or regulation upon which the DNF is based.
All right, well done. Folks were paying attention 2 weeks ago. And, of course, among other things, the contracting officer, when making a determination and finding, needs to always have that legal foundation as to why that finding is correct. And also, to some extent, Margaret, referring to the citation that requires that the contracting officer needs to establish a determination and finding before taking a contract action. One of the, from my perspective, most common example is when the government makes, contracting officer makes the decision for instance, to issue a time and materials type contract. That requires the CO to answer a series of questions, responding with determinations, amongst other things, why some other contract type is not available to the contracting officer. So that's very important. A written legal opinion from agency counsel is not required by the regulation, but consulting with your agency counsel at times might be appropriate. It certainly might give a contracting officer a second set of eyes or a different perspective, Margaret, before taking a certain contract action. So although not required, it might not be a bad practice. The signature of the contract awardee, not necessary. The only awardee signatures that's going to be required is to sign off on a contract or a task order or a delivery order. And I'm not aware of any instance where a contracting officer is required to submit or in any type of agency contract file their picture. So let's move on to the next poll, John.
All right, Patrick, please post the next poll.
Poll 4 should be live. Give this a few more seconds and I'll close it out.
FAR 52.201-1 definitions is required to be incorporated in all federal government contracts. True or false? All right. I think we can
Looking like we got a 85% true.
All right. Well, those who answered true, you are correct. Those who answered false, I'm sorry. True is not correct. True is not. The answer is false. It's not required. The reason for that is the FAR Council tells contracting officers that a procurement below the simplified acquisition threshold does not require the inclusion of 52.201-1. Nonetheless, Margaret, I'm not sure what your feelings are. I always say it's a best practice. This is an instance where it might not be required, but is probably a good idea. Again, that's just me speaking for me.
I've got a question.
I agree with Steve, and I also think you see it there already anyway, because I think a lot of contracting officers are used to adding it.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Steve. We talked about this a little bit. Is definitions a Christian clause in the contracts it must be added to?
The bottom line is it's mandatory to be included in all procurements in excess of the simplified acquisition threshold. So the answer to that, and more importantly, that particular contract clause is considered to be to the benefit of the U.S. government. So, yes, that would be a clause that would be subject to Christian.
All right. For those of you who don't know, Christian means that if your contracting officer forgot to put it in the contract, it's still there. All right. Patrick, can you post to the next polling question?
Yep. It should be live.
Contracting officers do not have which of the following responsibilities or authority in the procurement process? Assigning definitions of words differing from the FAR definition, creating the terms and standards of the solicitation defining the government need, eliminating all contract risk when executing or administering the contract, or finally, delegating authority to a contracting officer's representative to monitor the contract. I really like this question.
And I think to some extent, John, I would add the words ability as well as responsibility or authority.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to close that. Margaret, which one of these? Which one of these is do you think is correct?
Oh, you're putting Margaret on the spot. She wasn't here.
I know, John. It's really tough. There's a lot of pressure here. I'd say number one, assigning definitions of words different from the FAR definition.
All right. Well, Margaret, believe it or not, at 202-1, that is one of the things a contracting officer is able to do. If they do define a word differently than that set forth in the clause in 2.101, they need to make sure that that new definition is in the solicitation so that the contractor understands what that definition is.
Okay.
The correct answer is eliminating all contract risk. The FAR Council makes very, very clear at 1.102-2C that eliminating all risk is cost prohibitive. And the government, the U.S. government, needs to understand that if a contracting officer in a contract tried to eliminate all risk, the government would probably be paying a lot more money. So they're saying, don't worry about that. What the FAR Council tells contracting officers to do is to use good business judgments. And to the extent that risk is known, it should be identified as known. But eliminating all risk is never a good idea. And we know that, Margaret, from a commercial perspective. It's cost prohibitive if you tell the seller that the buyer is not going to take on any risk. So that is not something a contracting officer either has a responsibility or ability or even authorized to try to do. I think that's good practice. Before we move on to FAR Part 3, John, there is one thing I'd like to go back to in FAR Part 1. And from my perspective, and to the extent you can write this down, please do so. There is a statement in FAR Part 1 that is probably, from my perspective, Margaret and John, is probably the most important tenet that a contractor and a contracting officer should understand. And it's actually so important, the FAR Council repeats itself twice in FAR Part 1. The first time is at 1.102, D as in David. The other time is at 1.102-4, E as in Edward. And I very rarely will read you verbatim a part or subpart or section or subsection in the FAR during our journey. But this one's so important, I'm going to do that. The FAR Council tells the acquisition team, contractors and government, in exercising initiative, government members of the acquisition team may assume if a specific strategy, practice, policy, or procedure is in the best interest of the government and is not addressed in the FAR, nor prohibited by law, statute, or case law, executive order, or other regulation, that the strategy, practice, policy, or procedure is a permissible exercise of authority. From my perspective, Margaret, that is and should promote innovation in how the government decides to make procurements more effective. And I think in the past there has been a whole host of instances where that has been made available. One of the first examples in my experience is when the government buyers back in the 1980s decided to use time and materials. In the early 1990s, they decided to add the use of time and materials and labor hour task orders and delivery orders off of the federal supply schedule that's issued and implemented by the General Services Administration, because originally they were only allowed to make procurements using firm fixed priced orders. Another instance is, from my perspective, Margaret, is the greater number of contracting officers that are using firm fixed price level of effort type contracts that might be a little bit different than what is established in FAR Part 16. We're going to talk about that a little bit later during another episode. But innovation is important. Contractors, it's important for you to know that if there is a technique or a strategy or practice that you might like the government to promote, bring it to their attention. But more importantly, also cite those two citations. 1.102D as in David, and 1.102-4E as in Edward. Innovation, innovation, innovation. All right, let's move
on. Steve, can you give us just a very quick example of where you have seen that work very effectively? The contractor proposes and the contracting officer is like, yes, innovative, let's go.
I think I've already talked about that, Margaret. It is when back in the early 90s, contracts for services, the contractor community said buyers on the commercial side don't use firm fixed price contracts. They purchase our services on a labor hour basis or a T&M basis. And there was nothing in the FAR that expressly prohibited that. It prohibited cost reimbursement contracts, but the contractors initially took the position that labor hour rates are fixed. They're fixed unit rates. They're not based on cost. And that was, from my perspective, the first instance where I said, wow, here's somebody who was a contracting officer said, yes, I'll do that. And then eventually, of course, it became part of the law. And again, we're going to talk that a little bit more in FAR Part 8, where we talk about GSA schedule contracting, and FAR Part 16, we talk about contract types. All right.
All right. We did have a hand raised, and I believe they were asking if we are where we want to be on the slides, and we are. We don't push the slides forward until we get to Part 3.
Which we're going to do right now.
All right. Let's get started.
All right. And oh, by the way, I provided you all with my background 2 weeks ago, but I've got a wonderful guest here today, Margaret Cassidy. Margaret works for her own practice. Margaret, why don't you just spend maybe a minute telling the folks what your background is, and more importantly, how you got initially involved in federal government contracting.
I got to go off mute. Steve's correct. I have my own firm. And prior to having my own firm, I worked at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Eventually, as their government ethics and compliance leader, that's where I met my friend and colleague, Steve Doust. And I will tell you, I learned from Steve Doust all about federal government contracting when I first joined PricewaterhouseCoopers, and that enabled me to do my job more effectively there and my job now. Prior to PwC, I worked for the General Electric Company for their division called Transportation, which made locomotives and signaling devices, and we sold signaling devices to the federal government. And I was their global compliance counsel when I was at GE. I did the same things at both places, essentially helped those businesses make sure that when when they sold stuff or interacted in any way with the federal government, that we did it correctly. Before that, I was a prosecutor for a long time in the state of Pennsylvania. I prosecuted corruption and fraud and conflicts of interest and all of those types, ethics violations for the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office. Before that, I was a prosecutor in the Allegheny County DA's office, which is the county of Pittsburgh. And very early in my career, I started off as a law clerk in Ohio. And for those of you that know lawyers, that's a very common thing that we do immediately after graduating from law school some of the time. I went to Pitt, University of Pittsburgh for law school. I'm a proud Ohioan. I grew up outside of Cleveland, and I went to Miami University, the real Miami University, which is in Oxford, Ohio. And interestingly, for a lawyer, I was actually a finance major. Most lawyers are in the arts and not in something like finance. So that's me. I live in the Virginia area and am colleagues and friends with Mr. John Plinke, who gets me through all of these every time I am doing one of them.
All right. Thank you, Margaret. Let's jump into FAR Part 3, which the FAR Council entitles Improper Business Practices and Personal Conflicts of Interest. If we take a look at 3.1, which establishes the foundation of the rest of the FAR Part, and one of the things that I love about the FAR Council is it always provides a good introduction as to what we're going to be reading for the rest of that FAR part.
Yeah.
And in this instance, in the background and overview, right, in 3.101-1 and 3.101-2, it tells the readers, the acquisition team, that government business shall be conducted in a manner above reproach and except as authorized by law, with complete impartiality and preferential treatment for none. And it also goes on to state that transactions, because they're using public funds, should be conducted with the highest degree of public trust and an impeccable standard of conduct. Now, Margaret, one of the things that I did, because I'm a lawyer and words are important, and this is my 10th journey through the FAR where I'm reading every single word, I actually looked up what the word impeccable means. And impeccable means the highest standard of propriety. And then the second definition is faultless. And then when you look at the word propriety, it's basically a standard of morals and ethics. So one of the things that we need to understand when we review FAR Part 3 is we're looking at conduct that at times someone might think it's perfectly legal because there's no criminal statute that says I can't do it, but nonetheless it violates a certain ethical code that in this instance the FAR Council is promulgating. But also, Margaret, you and I know that corporations or contractors establish their own ethical code that go beyond what's legal and not legal. So that's an important framework that we need to take into consideration.
And Steve, I know, you know, you hit on contracts all the time. I think in what words mean and what words matter, a lot of times I'll be working on either a subcontract, either representing the prime or the sub, and a lawyer who is not steeped in our world, when I say will act in compliance with the laws and with and act ethically, that lawyer will jump back to me and say, well, Margaret, there's not really a definition of ethical conduct. I will then return and say, oh, but for federal government contracting, in my opinion, there is, and it sits in FAR Part 3. So I think that is what should not override your interactions with the government, but it should override your interactions with your primes and your subs as well. So I think I agree with you.
And I one of the things that is a fine example of this whole concept of, do I need to worry about whether my action is legal or not legal, is when the FAR Council talks about the fact that not only should a government procurement official, and I will take the step, a contractor procurement official or employee, needs to not only avoid the sin, but the appearance of the sin. And again, I'm saying, I'm talking as a former Catholic student, a Catholic school student, where I was taught avoiding the near occasion of sin. Well, in this case, the FAR Council, as an example, says not only does the government need to avoid actual conflicts of interest, it also says they need to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest in government contractor relationships. And we're going to talk about that a little bit further.
Okay, guys, this is a great time for the first password. The first password today is the word stooges. Stooges. Write the word stooges down. You'll need it after the program for two different reasons. Each of these passwords, including the first password, stooges, when combined with the other three, will form a trivia question. The first person to answer it correctly in the chat will win a fabulous PCI prize. The second reason you want to save them is you all have a login to the PCI website. If you don't know yours, reach out to me. I'll help you. When you log in, you'll want to go to My Certificates and Courses and put the passwords in the Fun with the FAR Season 2023 course event. That'll help you. That'll slowly generate your certificate throughout the year. Once you've gotten all of those filled out at the end of the year, it'll create your certificate for you. All right. Stooges. Take it away, Steve.
Thank you, John. I've always taken the position that the FAR Council establishes back in April 1st, 1984, Margaret, April Fool's Day is when the FAR was promulgated and published.
You could also call it Margaret. It's also Margaret's mom's birthday as well, so you can note that in the future.
Fun fact. They, from my perspective, intentionally put FAR Part 3 at the very beginning for a reason. For the same reason that they put the acquisition principles and the definitions in the first part of the FAR, because they're important. And if we take a look at FAR Part 1, and I'm probably going to do this going forward throughout our journey, we're always going to come back to some extent, where in FAR Part 1, where in those acquisition guiding principles does this particular FAR Part act upon? In this instance, there's the acquisition principle that says conduct business with integrity, fairness, and openness. In part, FAR Part 3 is addressing that acquisition principle. One of the things that contractor professionals, the sell side, and government procurement officials from the buy side need to understand is another important tenet that's found in FAR Part 3. And it tells government personnel that their conduct needs to be such that they would have no fear or reluctance to have their contract action be published or disclosed throughout the community, or throughout the world for that matter. Margaret and I, back in the day, used to refer to that as what was referred to as the New York Times test, or in Washington, D.C., the Washington Post test. Contracting officials were told, you know, before you take action, is there something about what you're about to do that would not reflect well on you or your agency if made publicly available? And I would say the same thing for contractors, Margaret. Is there something that you are going to do that if it was made public, or what I always often would say when I was a compliance officer, Margaret, like you, is there something that you might be about to do that if disclosed to your father, your mother, your wife, or your children would cause you to be embarrassed? That's known as the public knowledge or public public disclosure test. Now, Margaret, we always use the term New York Times because, you know, back in the day, that was considered to be one of those preeminent newspapers, and it had a very high circulation rate. And for a very long time, it had the highest circulation rate amongst any other newspaper. I am going to give a brand new season 10 t-shirt to the first person who can tell me what newspaper today has the highest circulation. We have a... So let us know which newspaper basically took over. All right. Patrick, if you could tell me, because I've seen the answer already, who was the first person who typed in USA Today?
It was Carrie.
Carrie?
Carrie.
All right, Carrie, congratulations. You are correct. USA Today is the newspaper that has the highest circulation amongst any other U.S. newspaper. So to some extent, Margaret, it's no longer the New York Times test. It is the USA Today test. Carrie, if you could tell Patrick offline what your T-shirt size is and what your address is that we should send it to, please do so. Congratulations. You just won our first T-shirt for this season 10, which is great T-shirt. I love it.
I thought what you were going to say, Steve, is I, Steve, am getting ready to make a declaration that that's not the most read thing anymore, and I thought you were going to change it to the Facebook or the Twitter test.
No. No, I would not do that. The USA Today test is what I would call it. All right, so Margaret, you and I are former Catholic school kids, and, you know, one of the things that we were always told is thou shalt not do things. So one of the things that I use when discussing FAR Part 3 is I split up the sections into FAR 2, thou shalt nots for contractors and thou shalt nots for government procurement officials. So let's start with the contractors, Margaret.
Ready.
The first and foremost. I don't want to say foremost, but always gave me concern, was thou shalt not give improper gifts or gratuities to a government employee. Thou shalt not give an improper gratuity to a government employee. We're going to talk about the thou shalt not for the government official, which is a little bit different. But in nearly every single government contract, there is what's known as the gratuities clause. And the gratuities clause makes very clear that a contractor shall not give a gift or a gratuity, and I'll use the phrase, Margaret, something of value, to a government employee, this is important, to obtain a contract or favorable treatment under a contract. That to violate the gratuities clause in your contract would require the contractor to give something to a government procurement official with the understanding that the government official is going to do something back or not do something back. To use the Latin phrase, quid pro quo. That's an important distinction than when we get to the instance where we talk about the government official receiving a gift and what prohibits them from receiving a gift or gratuity from a contractor. The contractors are told, don't do that. Good contractor ethics and compliance officers or the policies they promulgate will often say, don't give any gift to a government official regardless of whether you're expecting anything back. Or they will say, don't give anything to a government employee unless otherwise authorized by law or statute or regulation. Because there are some limitations and some limitations to the standard rule that might apply, some exceptions that might apply. Anything else about contractor thou shalt nots, Margaret, before we move on to pricing, independent pricing determinations? Can't hear you.
Three things very quickly. This is your certification in your contracts, but also behind this, giving something to influence a government official, there's a whole body of bribery and corruption and conflict of interest laws that could be implicated as well that would be considered criminal, not just violating the FAR. I think that's one thing. Second, Steve talked about you give it expecting to get something back. The thing is, to have done wrong here, you don't have to be successful. So if I try and I think to myself, I'm going to give my contracting officer, Steve, a gift to see if I could get some favorable treatment here. And Steve is like, get out of here, Margaret. I'm not taking it. Under criminal law, I've crossed over. I've attempted, and an attempt is often as good as a crime. And then three, I think this goes to Steve Doust's point when he talks about conflicts of interest, about how the appearance could be as bad as reality. Even appearing to try to do or give something to a government official, and other people see you attempting or thinking about it or talking about it or something of that nature, this goes to Steve's point of why lots of contracting companies don't allow for it at all. The appearance could look as bad for you, I think, as doing it in reality. Those are my three points.
Absolutely. And Margaret, you know what? We have what's called the ring of truth. And I agree with that 100%. And all of you out there, to the extent you hear something throughout the next 50 weeks that you want me to ring the bell because you agree with it 100%, tell me to ring the bell in that chat box. But Margaret, that's spot on. I think that's wonderful guidance to contractors and to government. And we're going to talk about whistleblowers and how that is going to come into play as well with regard to why contractors, to some extent, often will have a very strict rule because they know that once the government receives a whistleblower complaint or a hotline call, the government can't ignore it. And at times that can disrupt business for the government customer as well as the contractor, even if something is not improper. Nothing improper has happened. But you're absolutely right. The fact that a gift was not even successfully given could cause an issue. And you and I both know sometimes these things pop up during a completely different investigation for something else. Someone's going through a contract file or a email file, and all of a sudden there's something that pops up, right? This email between the government and a government customer and a contractor. Someone says, ooh, that doesn't seem right. Margaret, you're still on mute.
I'm not talking. I'm just over here agreeing.
All right. The next thou shalt not is – not on this slide, but I'm going to talk about it briefly, and that's independent pricing. Similar to the gratuities clause, there is a contract clause that basically states that you, contractor, agree that the pricing you're offering the government is independent. And more importantly, that you haven't shared your pricing with any of your competition. And it's a concern.
Steve, does that apply in every single type of contract that I could enter with the government?
Well, you know what? Let's go to the we'll go to the clause. I don't believe there might be an instance where for commercial, believe it or not, for commercial services contracts or products contracts, it's not applicable. And the reason for that is price is not normally a factor because it's already a published price. But I think there's an exception to for those types of contracts with regard to independent pricing. Here's where this issue actually pops up in real life. There's often situations, Margaret, where a contractor intends to bid as a prime on one team and at the same time might be part of another team as a subcontractor. And so in other words, they're involved in two separate competing bids. That's a concern for your federal government customer. And more importantly, it's a concern for any contractor who certifies they're using independent pricing. And what a prime contractor, from my perspective, should do. To the extent you're bidding as a prime, as well as a subcontractor, you need to make sure that the people who are involved in those two different teams are completely separated and that there are no communications between those two sets of employees during that procurement, because there will be a concern, and that might be considered a red flag for your government customer about pricing, especially, Margaret, if the pricing that's offered by one team and another team looks remarkably the same. That could be a concern. The government also has a different red flag with regard to identifying potential issues when we talk about antitrust, which to some extent pricing, independent pricing, kind of ties into. There's a concern that two competitors are colluding with regard to pricing. In other words, at times there's an agreement that you agree that you won't charge less than X. And if there is a communication between two competitors that requests that, if prime contractor A tells prime contractor B, we both agree, or I would like you to agree that you will not charge the government more than X or less than X, the government could make the determination that you're engaging in what are called anti-competitive practices, which is a
I think you were going to say it violates the FAR, and it's the thou shalt not in the FAR, but similar to the gifts, which are like the gateway drug to bribery and corruption. Even if you don't have a FAR contract, even if you are just a non-government business, you are subject to the principles that Steve just talked about, antitrust. Writ large, freedom of competition, setting prices, colluding on prices defeats that freedom of competition. And especially as Steve just explained, for the federal government contractor, where one of the main goals of the federal government contracting process is transparency, and then second, competition. This is where Steve's thou shalt not really come into play, I think.
And we've gotten a request for a bell, Margaret. Great job. We've got a question here. Can this apply to underbidding a procurement, which is a different thou shalt not, which basically talks about the government's risk for awarding a contract that's known as buying in? And from my perspective, the greatest tool that the government has to avoid buying in is a good independent government cost estimate. And if that government cost estimate, if the bidder comes in with something significantly lower, the first question the government should be asking is, explain why. Explain why. We think your price is too low. And we're going to talk about that in FAR Part 15 as far as a negotiation technique. Normally, the government's going to say, we think your price is too high. But there might be a situation where it's too low. And the reason why the government's concerned about a bid that's too low is the contractor, upon being awarded that very low price contract is going to try to make up for it through significant change orders. And I think more often than not, Margaret, this is going to come into play probably only in a firm fixed price type contract, where all of a sudden the government, the contractor is going to say that was not in our bid. Patrick, go back to the second slide, the thou shalt nots for the contractor. Other instances of anti-competitive practices, and they're all set forth in 3.3. And the Department of Justice has what's called their red flag document that tells prosecutors, if you see certain conduct, then that is a red flag that anti-competitive procedures or practices are being undertook by competitors, not only in the federal marketplace, but in the commercial marketplace. It's often not just price that contractors or competitors are agreeing to. It could be whether someone will bid on a particular procurement. I have seen two companies agree to basically share customers. You agree you will not bid on any DoD contracts, and we agree we won't bid on any civilian contracts.
Cool. And also, Steve, I think recently DOJ in the past couple of years has gone after companies for agreeing not to recruit and hire certain employees, to provide certain employees a certain salary. Like, we're going to provide all software engineers with 5 years of experience this type of salary. And I call up Steve and say, you know what, here's what we're going to pay 5 year software engineers. And he's like, we're on it, Margaret. We're going to do it. That is what's the type of thing DOJ is looking at.
Right.
And that's criminal.
The other instance, another red flag beyond what's with regard to market, basically trying to restrict market share, trying to restrict pricing. There might be situations where a contractor, two contractors agree to not bid on a particular task order competition. In other words, we won't bid on task order competition one if you don't bid on task order competition two. So in other words, what the government wants in most circumstances is to have the greatest number of contractors to play and to respond, because the thought process is, and again, we talked about this in FAR Part 1, competition is good, full and open competition is good from my perspective, two reasons. One is competition promotes technical innovation, and competition drives price down. And that is in the best interest of the government. Competition is good. The next, before we move on beyond antitrust, Margaret, this is a real case scenario. Two competitors submitted the exact same proposal, including the same exact typographical mistakes, grammar mistakes, missing words, and you all might think that's crazy, but it has happened. And it happened to two of the largest government contractors in the world. It happened, those two contractors was Lockheed Martin and the Boeing Corporation. And you might say, how did that happen? Well, the reason why it happened is someone from the Lockheed Corporation, he was a business development employee. He drafted the proposal for a bid. And sure enough, the proposal date had not arrived yet, and he moved over to another company. And you wouldn't be surprised. He was assigned to work on that bid, on that proposal for Boeing. And he got caught up, really, really tight deadlines, and he just decided, I'm going to use the same document that I took with me from Lockheed. And he submitted it. Now, of course, the government saw that as a concern. In this instance, the Boeing Corporation was able to say, we didn't know he brought that over with him from Lockheed Martin's. But that is a concern for us, Margaret, as former chief compliance officers. Whenever you're a contractor and you're hiring someone from your competition, you need to inform that employee before they start day one. Do not bring anything with you from your former employee. We don't want it and we don't need it. Do not do that. And that should be an understood best practice.
And it should all go further as well. You should tell when you hire from the government also, because you may remember, Steve, there was a big case where Booz Allen Hamilton had the same exact problem when somebody from the federal government joined their team and brought information that was non-public from the government, and it doesn't end well.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. Contingent fees. The FAR Council makes very clear that the paying of a contingent fee, and that is money that will be paid if a contractor wins an award. As a general rule, the government frowns upon that. But there's a huge exception, right, Margaret? And the exception basically is paying a contingent fee to a person is permissible if the person you're paying is a bona fide employee, meaning if it's one of your business development folks within the contractor organization. And often their bonuses are tied to awards. The government's going to say that's okay. The government will also say that it's permissible to pay a contingent fee based upon award of a contract if it's being paid to what's known as a bona fide agency. Now, that rule is a little bit harder, or that exception is a little bit harder to approve, because the contractor, to meet the definition of a bona fide agency, needs to prove that this is a company or consultant that is in the business of business development to federal government agencies. And it's often helpful if that business consultant or consulting agency does work for multiple agencies and not just one. And the government will also look to see whether the fee is reasonable in the industry, because if it's out of whack, if it seems it's considered substantially high, like this is crazy what you're paying this person, simply to the extent that they have help you win an award. The last thing the government will often ask is, what did the consultant, Margaret, or the consulting agency actually do? What did they do? Because if you're paying a consultant or a consulting agency a contingency fee, from my perspective, even if it's deemed reasonable in the industry for having one meeting, that could be a red flag, right, Margaret?
Oh, Steve, I totally agree. And I think another way to think about this is it goes to what Steve has talked with you all about transparency, right? What they're trying to avoid here is, you know, unfair motive, like something like, if Steve's going to pay me a contingency fee that's so high, it provokes me to go out and do something improper being some of the things we're talking about here, then the government doesn't want you to do it. And getting a contingency fee that's too high can do that. But it's also transparency and some of the ethics requirements that our government colleagues are under about post-employment restrictions. So what Steve's talking about there, when you reach out or contact a former government employee, and even if they may be allowed to go back to the agency or have those discussions, that's a whole nother section here that we're going to talk about.
Right.
If, in fact, all they're doing is introducing you in a 15 or 20 minute moment to a decider at that agency, and now they're going to get a certain percentage of a $5 million contract, it's not going to look good for anybody, even if they may be bona fide.
Right. I think more often than not, if you are hiring someone simply to open a door, that is a potential red flag. And the reason for that is the government uses the term improper influence, Margaret. Right? And the concern is that the government shouldn't be paying, because to ultimately they're going to say, whatever this fee is, it's got to be showing up somewhere, right, for what's called improper influence, which is the wink and the nod, do this because the fear is there's money changing somewhere else. There's money being handled somewhere else. So that's a red flag. But the bottom line is, there is an exception to the general rule that payment of contingency fees is wrong or improper. It's not necessarily always violating regulation.
I think one thing, like what Steve said, is, about bona fide. Think to yourself, USA Today test, if somebody looked at what I'm paying this company or this individual for what they're doing to help me pursue and win government contracts, what's somebody going to think about that? Is it going to look bad? Is it going to look sort of improper? Goes to Steve's point about there's violating the law, crossing over that, but there's also what that perception is. So again, even in these agreements, you want to be impeccable.
All right. The next thou shalt not is using federal funds. And the regulations refer to what are called appropriated funds for a contractor to lobby. And before we get into that, it looks like there's another time. It's time for a password.
Password number two today is the word location. LOCATION. Location, location. Write the word location down. You'll need it after the program. Two, submit the passwords. And for trivia, location.
Okay, so the lobbying regulations are all called, to some extent, some of the people refer to as anti-lobbying legislation. It pops up at FAR Part 3.8, as well as two important contract clauses, 52.203-11, that's 52.203-11, and 52.203-12. The regulations and the contract clauses tell contractors you should not use money that the government has paid you under a federal government contract to pay an individual or organization to influence, and I'll use the word properly influence, a federal agency or a member of Congress or some other procurement official any money that you've made under a federal government contract. And I remember the first time I reviewed this, Margaret, and I went, well, what if all I do is work for the government? The FAR Council says, however, a contractor can use monies from profit to pay a person to try to influence a member of Congress or a member of a person who works for a federal government agency. And it's for an award, a modification, of some form of a contract. And the other exceptions to this general rule is it's okay to use appropriated funds to pay for your employees to try to influence a member of Congress or a federal government agency with regard to the award, a modification of a federal government contract. That's okay. You can also use appropriated funds if you need to hire a lawyer or need to hire an engineer in a situation where they're going to help you develop a proposal or develop a pitch to a government for those purposes. That's okay too. Those are exceptions that exist. The important thing is both with regard to 203-11 and 203-12, like some of these other instances, Margaret, a certification needs to be signed that says you're not using appropriated funds. So now we've got independent pricing, we've got gratuities, we have these lobbying regulations, Margaret, all require certification. You know where I'm going with this. Why does the government want a certification for these particular issues?
Well, before I answer that, Steve, I want to say this. A lot of people think lobbying is going up to Congress, going up to Capitol Hill to lobby around some piece of legislation. But Steve told us something really important, and that is lobbying can also be what sometimes us legal geeks call procurement lobbying, taking certain efforts to try to get the award of a contract. That too can be lobbying. So probably beyond what we're going to talk about today, but make sure you understand the definition of lobbying. And now I'm going to get to the certifications, because those certifications, when you sign them, just as when you sign your SAM certification, you're saying, United States federal government, what I am telling you, I don't lobby. I don't engage in improper gift giving. I'm independent in my pricing. When you're signing on the dotted line, you're saying as a company, and I would even say the person signing actually, that my answers are truthful, they're accurate, they're complete, and they're up to date. And failing that, like if your certification is inaccurate, incomplete, out of date, something of that nature, you're now in a situation where you're going to think, and I think this is where you want me to go, Steve, to the False Claims Act. And the False Claims Act says to government contractors and their employees, as well as people who do provide healthcare services, but Steve and I aren't in that business. We're going to talk federal government contracting. The False Claims Act says you make a false statement to the United States federal government in order to get a claim from the government. Claim is when the government pays you. Right. You make a false statement to the government in order to be paid. You could, if it's really reckless and really motivated by improper thoughts or behavior or plans, then you're going to face a criminal liability. If you're just kind of negligent and you don't do your due diligence on whether you're lobbying, then you could face a civil False Claims Act violation. And a statement, or when Steve and I use the term false, it's not like false, perhaps like a lot of people think, like false, you think like purposefully wrong, like some sort of fraudulent element to it, like a downright lie. Under the False Claims Act, the government takes the position that it's false if, like I said, it's inaccurate, incomplete, or out of date. So if you go ahead and say, we're not using lobbying, we're not using appropriated funds to lobby, but in fact, somewhere in your organization, you don't even know about it, appropriated funds are being used to lobby, you've made a false statement to the United States federal government, and they're not going to be happy about it.
Yeah, bad things happen, big payment, big fines are paid, people go to jail. Organizations could be suspended and debarred. We're going to talk a little bit about that when we had a conversation about FAR Part 9. But when a company signs a certification, it has meaning to your government customer, and it should not be taken lightly. Kickbacks. There is a statute called the Anti-Kickback Statute. This is a situation where a subcontractor is giving something of value. Could be cash, could be travel, could be a holiday, could be cars, could be boats, something of value to a prime contractor in exchange for favorable treatment during the award of a subcontract or during the performance of a subcontract. Favorable treatment is a term of art. It often means that the prime contractor is relaxing a requirement or that it necessarily shouldn't or doesn't have to in exchange for this particular payment of monies.
Steve, I was going to – I raised my hand to say it could also be deep discounts on pricing that you're not giving to anybody else. So – it could be a lot of things.
Or more often than not, the prime contractor might be, what the government's concerned about is whatever the subcontractor is providing as a contingent fee or as a kickback is actually eventually going to end up in their subcontract costs to the prime, which will be reimbursed by the federal government. Similar to gratuities, similar to antitrust, a kickback could be found simply through an offer. It doesn't have to be accepted, but simply making this offer could raise issues for the prime and the subcontractor under this particular statute. Let's jump into the thou shalt not. The next slide. Patrick, you're with me? The thou shalt nots for the government. We talked about gifts briefly, about giving gifts. The U.S. federal government tells government employees, not just, and these are federal agency employees, because the legislative branch has their own rules, the judicial branch has its own rules. But the U.S. federal government agencies, all employees, not just procurement officials, all employees are told that they should not receive any gift or gratuity from a contractor that's doing business with the government, is seeking to do business by the government, or is regulated by the government agency that that employee is working for. So it's very broad as far as the coverage of which employees are subject to these rules. As a general rule, a government employee should not receive any gift, unless there is a written exception. And before we get to the exceptions, Margaret, there is no exception if the government employee is receiving cash. Now, the regulatory department or office that's responsible for these gift rules is the Office of Government Ethics, the OGE. They have promulgated some amazing regulations and guidance to federal government executive agency employees, and they often provide wonderful examples as to what's permissible and what's not permissible. They tell government employees you cannot receive any gift of cash, and they've gone to this to even further, Margaret, any gift that's in the form of a gift card is also per se impermissible.
And if I may, Steve, you going back quickly to the Office of Government Ethics, Steve's exactly right. They're the ones that promulgate the rules and they give guidance. If you go to their website, Google Office of Government Ethics, as Steve said, they really have good guidance, both for government folks, but also for contractors, because you don't want to provoke your government colleagues into doing something that's a violation of the laws. And there's a lot of them. And so not everybody remembers them every single day of the week. So Office of Government Ethics, a great resource. I agree, Steve. I just wanted to underscore that.
Margaret and I could talk about this topic probably for about 8 hours. And there are multiple exceptions.
Possibly more than 8 hours, maybe a week.
You're probably right. But just so all of you know, especially if you are participants of Fun with the FAR, and there's a concern that any of these prizes that we might give you might be in some way violating this general rule with regard to gifts or gratuities. One of the significant exceptions, Margaret, is what's known as the logoed product exception. Anything that you might win as a prize is going to have a logo, either a Fun with the FAR logo or with a PCI logo. The Office of Government Ethics say that immediately diminishes the value of whatever you're given. None of our gifts would be considered exorbitant. We're not giving out any kind of polo shirts with regard. You're going to get T-shirts, right? Beefy T-shirts. You're going to be given things that in most instances are of what's known as de minimis value. But also one of the things that I want you to understand is anything that we provide to you is going to be earned. It's either interacting with us with a good question or a good answer. And more importantly, the value of the price that we offered you includes, to some extent, the opportunity to win gifts. So to the extent any of you on the government side are concerned, let me know. I've had conversations in the last 9 years, Margaret, with ethics officers, and they all say the same thing. Steve, you're absolutely right. They've turned to the government employee saying, no, it's okay. Don't worry about that. But the bottom line is, again, to the extent that you are concerned, let me know. We're here to help. We'd love to talk about specific exceptions, but unfortunately we do not have time, but we have in the, original source materials have provided you the citation of these gift rules. So, Margaret, let's talk about two very important issues about thou shalt nots for the government. They also involve contractors. And the first is protecting government-sensitive information and protecting contractor information during a procurement. The hiring and recruitment of government officials or government employees is also something we're going to talk about. And to the extent that a former government employee who's hired are going to be subject to what are called representational restrictions. They're all tied up and bound within a very important statute called the Procurement Integrity Act.
Steve, I think one of our guests noted in the chat room about the Procurement Integrity Act. So I think we have some people that are well aware of it.
Absolutely. I'm going to throw out I had fun with the FAR beanie. The Procurement Integrity Act was a result of a major scandal and more importantly, a major Department of Justice investigation. I'll give an I had fun with the FAR beanie to the first person who can tell me what the name of that project was. But Margaret, while they're answering that question, let's talk about the government's obligation to protect information during procurement. The government tells us, the FAR Council tells us that during a procurement, any documentation that is identified as source selection information, as well as other types of information, needs to be protected, and more importantly, should not be shared with contractor employees. And there's a good reason for that. And it popped up. And as a matter of fact, we've got a winner. Gabrielle, you're absolutely right. Operation Ill Wind, Project Ill Wind was the name of that Department of Justice. You just won yourself and I had fun with the FAR beanie. That particular scandal involved government officials, procurement officials, sharing budgetary, 5-year budget information, as well as other information with contractors that were able to use that information to win contract awards. These regulations tell the government, you cannot do that. During the window of that procurement, you shouldn't be sharing procurement information, what's called procurement sensitive information with contractor employees. It also flows down to contractor employees that are working on that procurement as well. They cannot share that information with contractor employees. I've seen situations where contractor employees are working for the government. They leave the government and then go work for the contractor community. And similar to that Lockheed Martin Boeing situation, they unfortunately take procurement information with them and might share it with the contractor. That is a violation of the Procurement Integrity Act. When you are a contractor and you're submitting proposal or bid information to your government customer, The government is obligated to protect it to the extent you properly market and tell the government they need to protect it. And a lot of, you know, a lot of people say, well, Steve, are there magic words that I need to put on my proposal information? Well, if you are working, for example, or submitting a bid under FAR Part 15, and we're going to talk about this in a few months from now, there is specific language that you need to put into your proposals to the extent you don't want the government to share it with anyone else. And I'm going to say this really slowly because I'm going to repeat it later, but I want to tell you now, 52.215-1E as in Edward, 52.215-1E as in Edward. Those are magic words. If you put the government on actual notice that you care about this information and you do not want to share it with anyone else, they are on legal notice that they should not do it. And if they do, they are subject to potential criminal and civil sanctions under what's known as the U.S. Trade Secrets Act. And the Department of Justice and government agency ethics officers and government agency IGs understand these rules and they care about them. But the important thing they're going to say is, was the contractor information marked? So you need to make sure you properly mark your documentation to get that protection. Margaret, recruiting government employees. I mean, we're coming down to our last 10 minutes. I want to make sure we cover some of these other topics. In a nutshell, the general rules for recruiting government employees.
I'm going to turn it over to John Plinky for a moment because I see a password that just popped up.
Yes, the third password today is the word museum. Museum. Write the word museum down. After the program, you should log on to the PCI website to put these passwords in at My Certificates and Courses. If you need help with that, feel free to email me. I'm John at publiccontractinginstitute.com.
Okay, Margaret.
Thanks, John. In a nutshell, when you recruit and hire somebody from the federal government, you need to remember, first off, recruiting starts very early. It's the moment you start talking about them coming to your organization. So you want to have policies and procedures up front so that you're aware of folks who you may have to take special care with before you can even have a conversation about recruiting them. Number two, depending on what a person does for the United States federal government, and I think, Steve, and jump in here, it's generally based on their relationship with you as a contractor, what they do generally, are they a contracting officer or do they have nothing to do with contracting? And then I think the last important one that comes into the fact analysis is how high ranking they are in the government. Depending on those facts, how high ranking they are, what their responsibilities are, and whether they interact with you or not, may put them in a situation where, number one, you can't even talk to them until they take a recusal effort and notify the federal government. Or number two, okay, maybe they could come to you, but they have to enter some sort of cooling off period. There could be a 1-year cooling off period, or it could be up to a lifetime of a cooling off period if they oversaw a program, and you were the contractor on that program. They can't ever then go ahead and communicate or work with the government on that. That's the highest level that I could do in a couple of minutes. Right. Steve, I hope you can fill it out a little bit.
Let me add this a little bit. A best practice for a contractor to avoid these Procurement Integrity Act issues with regard to recruiting and hiring former or current government employees is through your application process. I tell contractors there should be a question on any application: have you worked on a procurement that was awarded to us, or have you worked on a contract in which we performed that is valued in excess of $10 million and stop? If they answer yes, then further questions should be asked. If they answer no, then a lot of these recruiting restrictions will not apply. Now, the interesting thing is, as Margaret said, if a contractor sends a unsolicited notice to a government employee saying, would you like to come to work for us? That starts what's known as an employment contact employee. So that raises an issue for the government employee unless they answer no. What they can't say is no, but maybe later. If they say anything other than no, then they need to go see their supervisor and inform them of an employment contact. Now, in this conversation with their supervisor, and often the agency of ethics officer is there, the bottom line is there's no more further contact, then there aren't any recruitment issues.
And I would add too, Steve, to that, inserting a recruiting firm or recruiting professional in the middle of those conversations doesn't inoculate the government contractor or the government employee.
Right. With regard to representational restrictions, the Procurement Integrity Act also tells government employees, we're going to try to avoid some revolving door issues. To the extent you are personally and substantially operating with regard to these contracts with your new employer, you cannot go back. You cannot go back to your former agency and have any contact with them for purposes of any representation. Even to the extent you're just sitting in a room, you have to, any conversations you have about your former employer has to be behind what's called behind the scenes. The important thing with regard to hiring and representations is before, this is Steve speaking as a former ethics officer and an in-house counsel. Before you hire a current or former employee, it's always best to get a letter from that agent, from that employee's former government agency ethics officer. And you need to make sure the information the employee tells the agency ethics officer is true and accurate and complete, because based upon that, the agency ethics officer is going to tell the employer, yes, you can hire this person without restrictions, or yes, you can hire this person with restrictions, and I'm going to tell you what those restrictions are, or they might say, no, you cannot hire this person for at least 1 year. And if the contractor responds and says, I will follow your directions, there is no jeopardy to either the contractor or the former government employee if they're hired. Or well, if they follow the representational restrictions that the government lawyer or government ethics officer has set forth. It's known as the safe harbor rule. So it's important to get that letter. It's important to put that letter in that government and former government employee's employment file. And more importantly, it's important for the contractor to have a meeting with the government employee with the letter and have them agree that they understand, have them agree that they agree to follow, and also have them agree to contact the contractor's ethics officer if someone tells them to violate those directions. If you do that, you have safe harbor and you will not fall foul of the Procurement Integrity Act with regard to hiring or recruiting a government official.
I would add one thing to that, Steve. When you're having that conversation with them, also make sure that the facts and the understanding of the agency's lawyer was accurate as reflected in that letter. Because sometimes, as lawyers, we talk to our clients, you guys give us facts, you give us information, we write it down on a piece of paper, we may have misunderstood, we may not have captured everything, and that happens in the government as well. And so if the government lawyer doesn't accurately capture what that government employee was doing, your agency ethics letter is not going to necessarily be accurate, and it's important to catch that up front, and the government is always very good to reengage in those conversations. So that's the additional thing that I would add about that conversation that Steve recommend you have.
Okay, the last thou shalt not for the government is thou shalt not provide funds to a contractor who's received an award that restricts making disclosures to the federal government, meaning the agency, an agency official, a member of Congress, an IG, if you were a contractor, your confidentiality agreements need to make sure you carve out that you need to make sure that you need to say that this non-disclosure agreement or this confidentiality agreement does not pertain to your wanting or providing a disclosure to a member of Congress, to an agency ethics office, an agency inspector general, or a procurement official at an agency, that dealing with potential fraud, waste, or abuse under a federal government contract or order. And again, if you want the specific words, it's set forth here in FAR Part 3, as well as the contract clause that will be in your contract. This is a recent regulatory change, and Congress promulgated statutes to make sure that it was in there because they want as much information as they want. Margaret, that kind of goes to also FAR Parts 3 discussion about whistleblowers. A government contractor cannot discipline, fire, demote a person who makes a disclosure with regard to some form of wrongdoing under a federal government contract or order or procurement, provided it is made in good faith. There cannot be, the contractor is required to protect that employee. They cannot be disciplined, demoted, or in any way having their position diminished in any way for making that disclosure. It's important. And that will more often than not show up in a required ethics policy, because all government contractor employees, regardless of their size, regardless of any dollar values of their contracts, is required to have a written ethics and compliance policy. Margaret and I could have a full day discussion about what those policies should be. And to the extent you might want us to, let us know. We're happy to maybe have a separate session on that. And that takes us to the end of this particular episode. Margaret, as always, I appreciate you being with us. You've just won a I Had Fun with the FAR Season 10 t-shirt for being with us. I want to thank you all for joining us on this technically glitch-free episode. We know you have a lot of choices. I am thrilled to be with you for the rest of this journey. And until we see each other in 2 weeks, work hard, play fair, and go farther. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for joining us today, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
I want to tell Patrick to open up the feedback poll so that you can please tell us how you think we did today. We hope we did well, but if we didn't, we would like to know. In the meantime, I want to remind everyone to submit their passwords on our website after the fact. You can always reach out to John at publiccontractinginstitute.com, and I'll make sure you get help getting that submitted. All right. Thanks again for joining us, everyone. And we hope to see you again soon. Patrick, please close the poll.